I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. I'm going to be talking about Robert Maudslay. A lot of you will have heard of this case. Hopefully, the deep dive that I'm going to do may illuminate you and also bust some of the myths that I believe potentially exist around this case. I also spent quite a lot of time researching some scripts that I was sent from the testimony of a nephew of his. I was in a series that allowed me to actually see that stuff and hear that stuff direct from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So I've also got that familial perspective, or at least some familial perspective. Also, before I start, thanks everyone for your support. If you do like content like this, well, I release on a Wednesday and a Sunday, so get your notifications on and give me a subscribe. Give me a like, do all of those things all at once if you want to. And remember, if you like crime and consistency, this is definitely the channel for you. So I'm going to be talking about Robert Maudslay, and we're going to put him in the context of an individual being a serial killer. And serial killers usually, shall we say, earn their what can be noted as infamous reputations whilst they are free. It usually is when a serial killer is at liberty that they are able to strike. They're free to roam the streets, to stalk their prey. They kill to satisfy the urges that they have. And this continues until a serial killer is apprehended, usually. But in rare cases, a serial killer is, I would suggest, created after their incarceration to some degree. And when those cases arrive, I think it is a clear and damning indictment of the criminal justice system, the very thing that is meant to protect us from such people should also protect those who are incarcerated, because we appreciate that they have a knowledge that these individuals are within their walls and could indeed be very dangerous to other inmates. So it's really concerning when somebody kills another person in prison. Bear in mind that in the UK, the penal system is also all about rehabilitation, reformation, restoration, and making amends so that you can return to society without being a danger. You know, the whole premise is that we turn an offending criminal into a productive member of society. But sadly, I will say, before we get started, we're falling way short of these ideas. In fact, 75%, that's right, I did say that. I said 75% of ex-inmates reoffend within 9 years of release. Hardly a good statistic. And almost 40% reoffend within the first 12 months. It's not really demonstrating a great deal of progress and process as far as what happens whilst they're incarcerated, if when they get out, pretty much the vast majority of them end up offending again. So to some degree, we have to ask ourselves why, and I guess that part of that is that rather than rehabilitating, it turns out that offenders end up incarcerated, surrounded by other criminals in an environment where, to be fair, drugs are available, along with a lot of other things that are really not meant to be inside. So it makes it more difficult for people to be rehabilitated. So in circumstances like this, when we imagine the type of offender that we're talking about today and also who surrounds them, it is not surprising that some offenders' behaviour just spirals downhill whilst in custody. And there's some prime examples of this. Great one, Charles Bronson. So now known, by the way, as Charles Salvador. Apparently it's in honour of Salvador Dali, who's one of Bronson's favourite artists. He was labelled as Britain's most violent and notorious prisoner. Is one of those individuals who, let's be honest, has a charisma that makes us quite interested in who he is. He's got a proper personality, one would say. He was originally convicted of armed robbery. That was in 1974. And he got sentenced at that point to 7 years. He remains incarcerated to this day, almost 50 years later. Bear in mind, he was meant to go down for 7 years. 50 years later, he's still there. And he only ever tasted freedom for 12 months. That's it, in the entire interim. So it seems like more and more time was just added to a sentence again and again because he attacked other inmates and he attacked guards. Also, did take people hostage on occasion. And these attacks essentially led to a life sentence. So even though he should have been reformed, when James Callaghan was the Prime Minister in England. And if you're like, who's James Callaghan? When was there a James Callaghan? I mean, we've gone through quite a few prime ministers in the past, like, 10 years or so. But, like, who's James Callaghan? Yeah, James Callaghan. That's how long ago it was. I don't remember who he was either. But arguably, you can see how a system that's meant to help people raise themselves up has, in fact, added to the problems that that particular inmate I'm talking about certainly experienced. Another example of this kind of situation is the person that I'm going to talk about today, Robert Maudslay. Now, he's known as Hannibal the Cannibal. That's how he's referred to in the press. And I feel like so many myths have arisen about this particular man over the years, not least the fact that he's been accused of being a cannibal. It's bizarre. These kind of headlines get out and people are like, oh my God, he's a cannibal. How do you know? I read it in the Express. Oh my God, it's definitely true. I mean, papers never make things up. Papers are always verbatim the truth. Fact. Actually, Facebook fact checkers probably do have that saying, it is true and it is a fact. You know, it seems like fact no longer really matters in life, does it? So this has become a really big urban myth, urban legend, so to speak, in the UK. Also, there are some myths, in my opinion, about the motives behind the crimes that he committed, because he has become known as some kind of notorious vigilante who was going around taking out paedophiles. So as I noted at the very beginning of this, this concept of a just killing, an individual who, yes, is doing terrible things, but to some degree is liberating us from being surrounded by these predators. And again, that is something that when you talk about Robert Maudslay, often crops up in conversation with people who are aware of his crimes, that he was not really a bad guy. He was just a guy impacted on by his life experiences that we're going to talk about in a minute, who then decided to take the power back and do things about that, even though those things happened to be murderous. But let's look, before we get into his crimes, at the man himself and what formed him. So Robert John Maudslay was born in Speke in Liverpool in 1953. He had it tough. I'm not for one minute going to suggest that his childhood was anything other than chaos and pain and dysfunction and abandonment and all the challenging additions that go with that, including abuse. When he was just 6 months old, he was placed into care in Nazareth House in Crosby in Liverpool. He was placed with his older brothers, Kevin and Paul, and his sister, Brenda. Apparently, from what I understand from my research, their parents, George, was a coalman, and Jean, his partner, they were just unable to cope. The children were exhibiting signs of parental neglect, and in spite of the fact that they were all taken into care, and in spite of the fact that it was recognised that the environment at home was completely unsuitable, the same parents went on to have another 8 children. That's right. 8. Just kept going, even though they weren't really capable of looking after the children that they had that went into care. So, whole heap of dysfunction there. Now, Maudslay and his siblings, they spent 9 years, long period of time, isn't it? 9 years in the Roman Catholic run centre in Crosby, ran by nuns, the Order of the Poor Sisters of Nazareth. They apparently cared for children in dozens of homes across Britain. I use the term care lightly. The people that they were meant to care for, they included orphans, abandoned babies, and children who were deemed uncontrollable. I wish they had homes like that now, where babies that were abandoned and children that were abandoned would just be able to be given to people like me. No baby should be abandoned when people like me exist. But arguably, social services take it a little bit more seriously than just handing them over. But nonetheless, this was at a time where these children who should have had caregivers ended up in situations like this. The fact that they also worked with children who were deemed uncontrollable tells you that the actual environment may have at times been quite chaotic as well. Now, to the outside world, these nuns, of course, epitomised kindness and compassion, because, of course, we all know They were basically married to Jesus. That's what nuns do. And if you think about Jesus, meant to be a nice guy, but a pretty absent partner, apart from the times that you connect with him in prayer, which I suppose is like a really old version of a mobile phone. But in spite of the fact that these are meant to be vessels of virtue and chastity and love, turns out, in the case of these homes, the nuns were often not angels of Jesus. They were utterly sadistic bastards. So former residents of these homes have since spoken out and come out and talked about the levels of horrific abuse that they suffered there. And I mean, these regimes that these nuns, these amazingly kind humans ran, were actually ruthless beyond belief. The residents would often experience beating, sexual abuse, and acts of extreme cruelty were just meant to be daily occurrences. They were commonplace. The kids who used to live there would recall that the nuns would use canes, sticks, and that they wear leather belts around the waist just so they were available when they wanted to administer beatings. And the residents were basically treated like slaves. So they were just constantly used to clean, and they had to abide by whatever rules that were being placed there, and they had to suffer. Essentially, it's like the nuns believed that the children were sinful and that sin, for some reason, needed to be beaten out of them. That religious order, reportedly worth in excess of £150 million, they provided the kids with very little. So even though they were wealthy, their kids were given very spartan living conditions. They had a really miserable existence. And the worst bit about this is that the authorities knew. So Robert Maudsley and his family, his siblings, were growing up in a place where the authorities recognised kids were being regularly attacked and beaten and abused, and that they were being malnourished, and that they were being made to be humiliated, and they just let them carry on with it. They did nothing to stop. Hallelujah, praise the Lord. God is good. I know that it wasn't God doing that before. Somebody's like, Emma, it's not God who did that. It's the evil nuns. I appreciate that. I'm just saying it's such a juxtaposition from what you imagine would be going on there. Although some of you will be sitting there going, Emma, have you actually seen what priests get up to? I know. People in authority do things that they shouldn't because they're power mad and they put themselves in position where they can affect the vulnerable. I get it. But this is a really, really unhappy place to be growing up. I will note, there wasn't evidence to suggest that Maudsley and his siblings directly suffered abuse at that home. They may well have, but it's not something that's been talked about. But even if they weren't chosen to be the most abused, because again, we see that in these circumstances where certain children are selected to be abused and other kids tend to fare better in certain circumstances for whatever reason, they still could not have had an enjoyable start to life. They can't have. They had the dysfunction with mum and dad, and then of course they end up in this place, which may at least provide them with food and shelter, but certainly would have been difficult to witness other children experiencing enduring abuse or themselves encountering similar situations. I think we can say at this moment that the formation of Maudsley's future character was well underway. And I think that what's really shocking about this case with Maudsley is he's not in the worst place that he could be right now, because things are about to go even further downhill from here. At the home, he is at least with his brothers, and he became really close to his brothers. They felt really like a family to him. You know, it's his safe place. His parents did visit from time to time, very sporadically, but they were just strangers to him. He had been 6 months old when he was removed. And they were, as parents, what a chocolate teapot is to tea. For those of you who don't get that analogy, not very good. Not very useful. Unfortunately, his chocolate teapot parents suddenly decide that they want to be more involved in the lives of their first four children. I did say it was going to go downhill, his living conditions, and boy, it is about to, because it could have been amazing. Turns out there was this really loving family and they wanted to adopt Maudsley's older brother. And this triggers something in them. Bear in mind, for Maudsley's older brother, this would have been amazing. The parents suddenly think, no, I don't want anybody having my kids. So they stop the adoption process, and suddenly, bolt out of the blue, after all these years of the kids being cared for, loosely speaking, they want the kids back. So Mosley and his siblings end up going back to live with them. It's on a trial basis. They remain under the care of the council, but they go home. And it's horrible. His parents immediately begin a regime of horrific physical abuse against the four oldest children. And the father seems to have been the biggest instigator of this. He really enjoyed it. He was sadistic. But mum did nothing to intervene. So I have absolutely no sympathy or empathy for her. She's a contributor as far as I'm concerned. If you see your children being beaten and abused, and he beat and abused them in a horrible way, if you don't stand in front of them to protect them, you're a terrible parent. End of. She even was an instigator of the violence, so she knew how her husband would react if the children were not behaving, and whenever he came in, if they had been misbehaving, she would relay that, and then she would let him go ahead and punish the boys. And he loved to punish the boys. He would systematically beat them for no reason. He would lock them in the rooms. They didn't have beds on the hall, they'd just usually sleep on the floor. Also, again, very indicative of the kind of people that were bringing Maudsley up. One of the things that the father would say is, go out and steal lead from roofs. So he would get them to get involved in criminal acts. And the local community is also going to start seeing those boys as problems, aren't they? Because lead's expensive, and how dare somebody steal it from your roof? If the boys are getting identified as individuals who are doing these things, there'll be a level of alienation within their community, and that removes support and causes a bleak future, at least in the eyes of locals, regarding what they think of these kids. If they did happen to get caught when they were out robbing for their father, the consequence of that was they'd get beaten. So they were getting beaten when they failed to carry out criminal acts, which is highly confusing for any child. Like I say, the reality of being a kid is that you look to your primary caregivers to give you some level of support and guidance, and you want to make them proud. Even when they're asking you to do things that are wrong, you still want to make them proud, but you have your kind of moral compass within telling you that you kind of know that that's not acceptable, which causes utter confusion and chaos within. And Maudsley must have been in that state of confusion. Also, the boys have been being brought up by nasty nuns, shall we say, but they would have been dealing with a lot of scripture. They would have been having that force fed down them. They'd be being told that they were terrible people anyway, probably being taught all about things like damnation. And that would have been very chilling for the kids, because they're now out there doing the very things that they've probably been told will see them going to hell. Because Maudsley was like 6 months old when he went into care, his father really didn't have a relationship with him anyway. So it seems like he fixates on Robert as far as being the most abusive to him. So he's very violent and abusive. He locks him in a room. And when he locks him in that room, his father would then come in and beat him with his fists, with a belt, with a stick. According to Maudsley as well, he was raped by his father, which is just so challenging for any child to experience and encounter. But to have been taken home by your parents and maybe to be hoping for a life free of the regime of the nuns, and to end up in this situation where you're being sexually and physically violated, it's too difficult to even imagine for most of us. Maudsley said this about his childhood: all I remember of my childhood is the beatings. Once I was locked in my room for 6 months and my father only opened the door to come in and beat me 4 to 6 times a day. He used to hit me with sticks or rods, and once he bust a .22 rifle over my back. That, if you think about somebody recalling childhood, is as far away from the picture of what we'd expect a child to experience. Maudsley experienced this level of abuse for 1 year, because after a year, it was noted by social services that the conditions that he was dealing with were completely intolerable to childhood. They then remove Maudsley again and they place him in a series of foster homes. His father related to his siblings that Maudsley had died. Yeah, just your brother's dead. And I imagine it went something like that as well. They wanted to close down any conversations about Maudsley. They wanted to end the possibility of relationships with him. As far as they were concerned, he was no longer in their present in their life, and that meant that he was no longer living in their eyes. So the siblings are just told this massive lie. When you think about Maudsley's experience up until now, he's been removed from the only family he knew, you know, his nuns and brothers in the care home. He'd been placed into an abusive environment with his parents, who were basically strangers to him at that point. And then he'd been ripped, at least from the good relationships that he knew with his siblings, and just placed with more strangers. It's totally unsurprising that his behaviour was impacted. And during that period, he'd also been arrested for theft and burglary. So he has had such a dysfunctional childhood. It has had no continuity. It's been full of abuse. And now he feels completely alone. So you won't be surprised to know that in spite of being put in foster placements, as soon as he was able, he left. When he hit 16, in the late 1960s, he wanted out of that system. So he starts moving around the country, he's just doing odd jobs, and then he makes a decision to travel to London. Guess in the 60s, London was quite a happening place. There was a lot of talk about it being the land of plenty. It was an area that you would go to chance your luck at having a better life. Often didn't end that way, but certainly that was the concept that a lot of people had around the capital in the UK. But London didn't prove to have streets paved with gold for him. In fact, his life was on a complete downward spiral by this point. He developed a chronic drug habit. He even attempted to take his life on two occasions with an overdose. So his mental state was clearly in decline, and he felt lonely and isolated and in a place where he didn't even feel like he wanted a future. When he was on drugs, he needed to fund that habit. So the way that he starts to do that is to work as a rent boy in the capital. So a rent boy is a term essentially given to a child male prostitute, which makes no sense, because when you're underage, you're just a child. And if you're selling your body under the age of consent, it's because you are desperate. And at the end of the day, there are enough predators who will procure your services because there is something unhinged about that human being. We do use the term rent boy. I find it really reprehensible, that term, because it suggests that a boy can be rented and bought as opposed to protected and looked after, which is what we should be doing with children in these situations. Now, he would later state that one of the things that started to become very present for him was that he'd often get sexually abused by older men during this time. So he really started, in his opinion, to form this idea that older men could be very predatory. And allegedly, he develops this hatred of paedophiles. And that apparent hatred of paedophiles has been used as a reasoning behind his future crimes. His mental health was also really declining, and he gets admitted to psychiatric wards on multiple occasions. And when he was admitted to psychiatric wards, he would talk about the fact that he had voices in his head. And those voices were constantly telling him that he should kill his parents, which, when you have experienced the kind of childhood that Moseley had, I do have some sympathy with him having those thoughts. Obviously, the difference between thinking and action is that you can have your thoughts, but you can't do damage with them. But he had had a horrifically abusive time with his primary caregivers. He didn't remember them when he was an infant, but he remembered them as strangers who just attacked him relentlessly. And he'd had a year of that. When you think about him going into the psychiatric wards and talking about that, in hindsight, it seems like he was probably suffering from some kind of schizoaffective disorder, but it was never officially diagnosed. It's whilst he's working as a male prostitute that Maudsley starts his murderous campaign, so to speak. So he's 21 at this point. Now, I'm in no way trying to defend his actions at all. I won't throughout this. But we all need to acknowledge that this is a very, very damaged young man. He'd had a prolonged history of abuse, and it had been high level abuse. But that said, the idea of Moseley being some kind of vigilante, killing only sex offenders, that has been questioned a lot in recent years, because it seems that the evidence that we hear about in the press, and certainly even in documentaries, including the one I was in, kind of made out that the murders were almost justifiable homicides. And when you look at the evidence, I would say that that has not been proved at all. In fact, that whole idea may just have been concocted. And I bring you to the first murder so that you can begin to understand why I challenge some of the, what I consider myths around Maudsley and the intent he had behind at least the initial murders. So his first victim was 30-year-old labourer and alleged paedophile John Farrell. So according to the legend surrounding these events, Farrell is meant to have shown him pictures of children that he'd abused. And when Maudsley sees these pictures, he's absolutely triggered and he's taken back to the rage that he feels about his own abuse. And in response, Maudsley garrots him, stabs him, smashes him over the head with a hammer, and then Maudsley instantly hands himself into police and confesses to the killing. He tells them that he needs psychiatric care. Now, in spite of that being a very common story, and that's what a lot of people have heard about that killing, let's just go through it in a bit more detail. So it turns out that he tells police that on that day, he'd gone to the West End with a knife in his pocket because he wanted to hurt someone. But he said he couldn't find anyone to hurt. So instead, he goes to Playland, which is an arcade, because he wants to find somebody to hurt there. And this is a place that is frequented by gay men. Apparently, he couldn't find anyone. There was no one he could locate. But then he bumps into Farrell. And Farrell's been a previous client of Maudsley's. At the point that they meet, Farrell had been with another young man, but chooses to leave him and to go with Maudsley instead, which, believe me, was a mistake. So they end up back at Farrell's, and Maudsley hides his pocket knife beneath the bed whilst Farrell made them tea. And he told the police this. After we had tea and talked, we went to bed. Johnny got into bed and went to the side nearest the wall, and I got in the open side to be near the knife. We started to kiss and to masturbate each other, and I thought then of killing him, but I went on masturbating him thinking that the feeling might go away and that I might not feel like killing him in the morning. After we finished kissing and masturbating, we both tried to sleep, but we were both restless and started to whisper to each other. Then we went to sleep, but I still had the feeling I wanted to hurt him when we woke. So I got up, made a cup of tea. That was around 8, 10 a.m. or sometime about that. But then I had the same feeling. So he then goes on to say that after the two had breakfast and Maudsley had transferred the knife into his coat, Farrell apparently starts showing him pictures of young men he had had sex with. There were no mention in the interviews that these men were underage boys. Maudsley stated, all of a sudden this feeling came on. I took a knife from my pocket in my right hand. I rushed across the room and stabbed him in the chest. He fell back on the bed and got up and said something like, I've got to get out. The blood spurted out as soon as I stabbed him. He made a rush for the door and fell over a chair. It was the big armchair I had been sitting in. His head must have hit the door. His head was down by the door, and I stabbed him in the back or side quite a few times. I told him that I was sorry, but I had to do it. When I said this, I could see his face. I could have robbed the house, but all I wanted to do was kill someone. I put the knife in the sheath and went upstairs to the bathroom to wash myself. All I remember about John is seeing his face and saying I'm sorry. So after killing Farrell, he stated that he actually did think that he might go and kill someone else that day. But instead, he'd had a coffee, he'd managed to cool down, and then he'd called the police and he'd confessed. So he lets them know the crime that's just been committed. It was established that Maudsley didn't take a great deal from Farrell's home, but he did take £5, and that probably was to do with the fact that he wanted drugs. So he quite possibly killed Farrell just for drug money. So the idea that he killed him for any other reason is quite possibly a myth. I'm just putting it out there. Now, you won't be surprised, just thinking about what's played out, that Maudsley at this point isn't declared fit to stand trial. So he gets sent to Broadmoor. Broadmoor is a high security hospital for the criminally insane. It's housed so many notorious individuals over the years, including Peter Sutcliffe, Ronnie Crate, Charles Bronson. However, in spite of the fact that we now have Maudsley incarcerated, it certainly doesn't prevent him from continuing his own form, shall we say, of vigilante justice against the people he apparently hated most, which is sex offenders. Of course, that is if we believe that they are his motives and he isn't just a psychopath with completely irresistible urges to kill. Just throwing it out there, that is another possibility. 3 years after he's sent to Broadmoor, that's in 1976, he and another patient, David Francis, they end up holding a patient hostage for hours. During that time, they threaten to gouge his eyes out. And even though no one is killed at that moment in time and the person walks away alive, it feels a bit like this practice run for what happens a few months later. That's the 26th of February, 1977. But on this occasion, well, Maudsley turns against David Francis, the guy who he basically was holding another person hostage with months earlier. So David Francis is a convicted paedophile at this point. So we can say there is a trigger potentially for Maudsley acting the way that he acts. And Maudsley gets together with a guy called David Cheeseman to kind of carry out this retribution. Let me just tell you, Cheeseman was in prison for rape and sexual assault of a 16-year-old girl. I'm really struggling to find where the righteous rage is here. So we've got Francis, who's a convicted paedophile, and yet we also have David Cheeseman, who's raped and assaulted a 16-year-old girl, but apparently Maudsley's cool with that. Anyway, they drag Francis into a cell, they barricade the door, they tie him up with a flex from a record player, and then it's a horrific assault. Honestly, it's terrible. You can't imagine what this man went through. And don't get me wrong, what he was in Broadmoor for was despicable. And some people may even feel he's deserving of this kind of situation. But nonetheless, the idea of somebody going through excruciating pain for 9 hours is not pleasant to imagine. So they kick him, they beat him, they torture him for those entire 9 hours, and Maudsley ultimately garrots him. Staff were helpless to intervene at all. There was nothing they could do. They had this guy in a room and nobody could break into that room. So all the staff could do was listen to this man's screams. Allegedly, he was partially skinned. Apparently, they held his body up to the spy hole so that the guards could see him. They wanted to traumatize the guards as well. The killing was apparently, allegedly, in revenge for a homosexual attack on one of Maudsley and Cheeseman's friends. But like I said, seems like Maudsley was totally cool with Cheeseman being a convicted rapist. Bizarre boundaries. It's also this incident that earns Maudsley the moniker that had stick with him to this day, Hannibal the Cannibal. So according to a guard, Maudsley fractured Francis's skull like an egg. That's what he said. I'm not saying that. He said, like an egg. And when they eventually forced their way into the cell, there was allegedly a spoon sticking out of the man's cracked head, at which point Maudsley reportedly claims to have eaten some of the brain matter. This also gave him the nickname the Brain Eater. Quite a literal term if that had been the case. Now, according to a later autopsy, this is just rubbish. It's completely untrue. So whilst the deceased's brain was badly damaged, it was all there. And furthermore, the spoon that was sticking out of his head, it was actually half a plastic spoon, which Maudsley had fashioned into a crude kind of shank pointed weapon. And he'd rammed that into his victim's ear and that had penetrated his brain. So it's bull that he ate some of the brain matter. It's just a complete fabrication of reality. Now, this is what's weird. Bear in mind what I've just told you about a man who's been sent to Broadmoor because they felt he was unfit to stand trial because he was not sane. And then let's just go through those last two. You know, he's taken somebody hostage, threatened to gouge out their eyes. He's now murdered somebody after torturing them for many, many hours. And yet at this point, they're like, he's totally fit to stand trial. Pretty sure he's in Broadmoor, which is like for the criminally insane, and he's just done some things that are like very insane. Yeah, he's totally fit to stand trial. Anyway, I imagine that they just felt potentially he was too dangerous to be in Broadmoor. So he is tried, even though he killed a man whilst being a patient in a hospital for the criminally insane. Ultimately, he gets convicted of manslaughter and he's sentenced to life in prison, but he doesn't get sent back to Broadmoor. Instead, he's sent to Wakefield Prison, aka Monster Mansion. Yeah, that's what its nickname is. And the reason for that is it's housed really high profile, high risk sex offenders and murderers. Notable residents there have included Soham murderer Ian Huntley. If you haven't seen my video on the Soham murders, have a look because you'll hear all about him. Harold Shipman, haven't covered him yet, know a lot about his crimes. He offed himself before he got to serve his sentence because he wanted his wife to get his pension. Also, Lost Prophets frontman and convicted paedophile Ian Watkins, who I will cover at some point. So Maudsley was not happy about the fact that he's getting sent to this monster mansion. You know, he does not want to be, apparently, around all of these sex offenders. And he demands, as prisoners often do, to be returned to Broadmoor. And they're like, no, you're not going because you're not the governor. So this is 1978 when he gets sent to Monster Mansion. It takes just weeks until we meet, shall we say, a problem. Bear in mind, I don't know who was on watch in this scenario, because if you get a prisoner who has just been sent down for murdering an inmate at Broadmoor for the criminally insane, there's a little bit of me that's going to be like, I'm not so sure about this guy. Like, he murders people, for example, and also he has quite a rich history of being a bit of a problem. And now we're just moving him to the general population with loads of other violent sexual perpetrators. Does anybody think this could be, I don't know, like a recipe for disaster? But they just let this play out. And this is where he kills another two people. Yeah. So one day in July 1978, he allegedly wakes up, and obviously there's a range of things that you can do in prison. I imagine he was thinking to himself, shall I go and have a life skills class? Maybe I could volunteer at the kitchen, make a nice spaghetti bolognese. I don't know, go and read a book, do something that is able to take my mind off things. But there are obvious other options that he could come up with, and he does. He's like, no, I'm going to discount all of those possibilities. Instead, I think today I'm just going to kill as many sex offenders and paedophiles as I can get my hands on. That was the plan. And he had a specific number. He was like, why stop at one when you can kill seven? So that's what he decides he's going to do. He's going to kill seven people. It begins when he lures 46-year-old Salmi Darwood into his cell. Darwood was serving life at the time for killing his wife, so not a child sex offender, just throwing it out there. And Maudsley kills him by garroting him whilst repeatedly swinging him around and smashing his head into the wall, and then he just goes and hides his body under the bed. Yep, you're right. He got to do that when there are prison officers and prison population around. This seems like the opposite of what should occur in prisons, but he's not only got to murder someone in a protracted murder, he's now stuffed the body under the bed and he's off for a second victim. So at this point, he tries inviting various other prisoners into his cell. I'm imagining that they wouldn't be able to see the body, even though he can't get people in. A lot of people refuse. Part of my brain's like, because they walk and like, pretty sure that's the foot. Just going to vacate these premises. But he's unsuccessful. People don't want to go in there. And it's because of the way that he's acting, because they say they could all see that he had madness in his eyes. However, he manages to corner 55-year-old Bill Roberts in his cell. Now, Roberts was a sexual molester. He was serving 7 years for the sexual assault of a 7-year-old girl, which is beyond reprehensible. The type of crime that we're talking about there, aside from child murder, I think you're at the highest level of offending. He goes in, corners Bill Roberts, and he apparently stabs him whilst he's lying on his bunk. Then he hacks at his skull. He had this homemade serrated knife, and then he smashes his head into a wall. It took minutes for him to kill him. He then allegedly goes into the guards room and places the weapons on the table and says, you know what, guys, you're gonna be too short of the next roll call. Bit of what we could say dark humour there, if it wasn't based in actually murdering somebody. But yeah, he's literally being sarcastic with the guards. And immediately they place him in solitary confinement for the brutal killings. Of course they do. And he also at this point tells the guards, "I adore the sight of blood." Again, is that indicative of being a just killer? Or is that indicative of somebody who is seriously psychopathic? I will leave you to make up your minds. So he gets tried for the murders in 1979. This is at Leeds Crown Court. And he claims that during the period of him attacking the men, he believed that those men were actually his parents. He said, "When I kill, I think I have my parents in mind. If I kill my parents in 1970, none of these people need have died. If I killed them, then I would be walking around as a free man without a care in the world. I don't want to shatter your illusion there, Mr. Maudsley. But I think if you'd murdered your parents, you probably wouldn't be walking around as a free man because you murdered your parents. But I understand your logic. You're saying that if you had eradicated the people who'd caused you harm, then you would have made peace and had closure with the abuse that you experienced and could have got about your business without harming anybody else." Now, the argument that his defence team put forward was that Maudsley was walking around with this pent-up aggression and it had been caused by this constant childhood abuse. And that's how they played it, that he was a victim of circumstance and he was projecting this pain. But in spite of that, Maudsley was ultimately found guilty of 2 counts of murder. He was sentenced to life, and I don't know what this judge was thinking, but here we go. He was sent back to Wakefield Prison. Let's just put him back exactly where he's just murdered 2 other people, because I don't know, maybe he'll have changed. Now, the Home Secretary, Michael Howard, he then, after this sentence had been passed and he'd been found guilty of 2 counts of murder, said that this man should never be released. He felt that the threats of the public was just too great to ever allow this man to walk the streets again. The threat that Maudsley clearly posed to the prison population meant as well that he couldn't be within it. He couldn't be around other prisoners. He was somebody who could at any point murder another inmate. So he ends up getting kept in isolation. And they create this special cell. It's in 1983 this happens, and it's in the basement of the prison called The Cage. So this cell is designed so that there would be nothing he could use to injure himself or to injure a guard. And the decision was made at that point that this is where Maudsley was going to spend the rest of his life, in solitary confinement. When you go to that cell, you have to pass through 17 locked steel doors. The cell itself measures 18 foot by 14 foot. Now, that's larger than a regular cell. But bear in mind, Maudsley's not small, he's 6'2". On the outside is a solid steel door, and this opens into a small cage within the cell. It's encased in thick, transparent acrylic panels. They're basically unbreakable, bulletproof plastic, and the point of this is that they want to be able to observe him 24 hours a day. There's a small slot at the bottom where food can be passed through. His bed is made from a concrete slab. His toilet and sink are bolted down. The tables and chairs are made from pressed cardboard. When he's fed, he eats from a plastic plate, uses a plastic spoon. He's allowed to write using a biro because he's not allowed a ballpoint pen because it could be too dangerous to him. He could use it as a weapon against himself. And all he can see outside is a centimeter of sky through a ventilation hole. He spends 23 hours a day in that cell. And for the 1 hour a day that he's allowed out to exercise or to shower, he's escorted every time by at least 4 prison guards. When he exercises, it's in a small, high-walled yard. The description I've just given you is his life. His every single waking moment, bar 1 hour, in that small yard. When you talk to prisoners who've experienced solitary confinement, they'll tell you it is literally one of the most harsh forms of punishment. Yet 69-year-old Robert Maudsley has been kept in solitary confinement for 44 years. There have been lots of arguments about this. People have said it's inhumane to treat somebody like this. It doesn't matter how dangerous they may be, to actually put them in such a condition won't do anything to help them and could actually send them into a spiral of even more unstable mental health. So it's almost a form of torture. Bear in mind, one of the things that we can note by his situation is there's no form of rehabilitation taking place at all. So if there's no rehabilitation occurring, well, the only thing that you're doing there is damaging an already damaged mind further. It feels a little bit like, if I'm really honest, from the outside, that there's been a real concerted effort to just sweep an inconvenience under the carpet, to try to just pretend that Maudsley doesn't exist. And even though he's done these heinous crimes, remember, he's still a human being, and he's a human being who've had experiences that have been catastrophic for him during childhood. And yet he spent 44 years by himself in this Perspex cell. Maudsley's actually been quoted as saying this: "The prison authorities see me as a problem, and their solution has been to put me in solitary confinement and to throw away the key, to bury me alive in a concrete coffin. It doesn't matter to them whether I am mad or bad. They don't know the answer and they don't care as long as I am kept out of sight and out of mind." I think that's a good appraisal of the situation. Now, Maudsley apparently once went 12 years without a haircut because not one of the prison barbers dared to take that risk. So again, very inhumane. Maudsley nowadays apparently has a speech impediment. And the reason for that is because he's had such a prolonged lack of human contact. In fact, for decades, the only interaction that he had with another human was with guards or the prison door. And if you're with guards, depending on your relationship with them and their attitude towards you, they might not be speaking to you at all. They might be speaking around you, but they won't necessarily be prompting you for interaction. Also, he wasn't allowed any pictures on his wall. He wasn't allowed to buy stamps so that he could communicate with his family by letter. And he stated, "I'm left to stagnate, vegetate, and to regress, left to confront my solitary head on with people who have eyes but don't see, and who have ears but don't hear, who have mouths but don't speak. Consequently, I too am left with no voice, nowhere to turn but inward." Like I said, what he's done action-wise is reprehensible, but he's being treated wholly differently from other prisoners. How dare they have not, during this period of time when he's talking about this, have allowed him stamps to communicate with his family? How dare they not have given him his basic human requirements? Where is the dignity that even though he has done depraved acts, he still deserves? Maudsley says as well that he doesn't understand why he's being treated this way because he's only a threat to rapists, paedophiles and sex offenders. Now, I take issue with that, and I don't necessarily believe that that's entirely true based on the evidence of the murders, and that not all of them were individuals who were indeed fitting those categories. So it could just be that he is a psychopath with completely irresistible urges to kill. It's a debatable point. In the mid-1990s, he did spend some of his time in Pankhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight. Now, during this time, this is really important to note, psychologist Dr. Robert Johnson, he became the first person to sit down and interview Maudsley since his solitary confinement. He spent 3 years working with Maudsley, and he was making absolutely brilliant progress with him. However, completely abruptly, that treatment was stopped. There was no warning, and Maudsley was moved back to Wakefield. Now, Dr. Johnson believes that the authorities did this just to break Maudsley. And now there will be some bias. I think we can all agree Dr. Johnson will be somebody who spends his life dedicated to helping people who are potentially seen as unhelpable. And the fact that he was making incremental progress and getting to know Maudsley will mean that he probably felt he was an opportunity, a muse, so to speak, to really gain insight into the kind of criminal mind that Maudsley had, and to see whether you could break through helping him work through his trauma and so on and so forth, to a place where you essentially stop that individual being dangerous. And to have that taken away from you when you've made such good progress would be very angering. I appreciate that. But why would they just stop? If Johnson was making this great process and progress, he should have been allowed to continue to do that. And in fact, he said that every single time he made progress with Maudsley, the authorities would literally throw a spanner in the works. It felt like it was a concerted effort to never help Maudsley heal.
You see, the thing, Bob, I know in the past when I've tried to sort of face these things.
What's the thing?
You know, I'm just capable of doing anything, Bob, as the adult here.
Yes, exactly.
And that's what I've got to be cautious
absolutely.
Of, you know?
Absolutely right. You're keeping the speed on these things, right? All I'm doing is saying this is where we're going to move in due course.
I think what I've been doing, I think I'm effectively putting in pieces.
Right.
But I have to make sure the pieces fit.
Well, they will eventually, that's right, yes you do. You have to piece them together, yeah.
And I think that's come on fairly well.
I do. I think you're doing brilliant. I mean, you know.
In 2000, Maudsley petitions for his solitary confinement to be relaxed. And I cannot believe that in the year 2000, they weren't looking at this and going, look, there's something really wrong here. This guy is a threat. This guy is dangerous. But, you know, we have a lot of dangerous threats. We have people like Joanna Dennehy walking around in prison, and she just went out and randomly stabbed men and murdered men for absolutely no other reason than she liked the thrill. So how are we trying to suggest that Maudsley shouldn't be given some more basic rights? So he asks for a pet budgie when this request is denied, because he says, okay, well, I'm not going to get any more freedoms, I'm not going to have a relax from solitary confinement, can you bring something in that makes me feel like at least I have a connection? So he wants this pet budgie because he feels like at least he'll have some company. And then he says, look, if you're not going to allow me that, can I have a cyanide capsule to end my life? And I think that demonstrates just how helpless he feels. He's actually saying, could I have a budgie that could save my life? And if I can't have a budgie, can you give me a cyanide capsule so I can end it? He said this about the budgie. Why can't I have a budgie instead of flies, cockroaches and spiders, which I currently have? I promise to love it and not eat it. I appreciate he's being quite sarcastic in that. I promise to love it and not eat it. You know, he's playing into that whole cannibal idea around him, right? But it's really sad as well. He's saying, I'm lonely. Let me have connection. They denied that as well. Maudsley has been subjected to a level of solitary confinement that has never, ever been seen before in this country. And this is only going to increase. Because in December last year, he was told he will never be released from solitary confinement. He'll remain in his underground prison until he dies. Ironically, and this is ironic, the reason that the authorities have come to this conclusion is for this reason. They fear that he's been alone for so long that that's going to increase his risk. Yeah. So the fact that they have put him in solitary confinement for all of these years is now being used against him as another reason why not to put him into the general prison population, because that could make him more of a risk. Really? Well, at this point, you lose me, because if you recognise that you have done him serious damage and you can't put him back in the general prison population, you should certainly be giving him something that can make his experience to death bearable. Even if that's somebody offering him regular therapy or a pet so that he doesn't have to suffer the indescribable loneliness that this solitude will bring him. I'm not sure. And I'm not trying to be sympathetic and empathetic to somebody who's done some horrible things. I'm saying you can't treat one prisoner completely differently to the way that you treat others who have equally done terrible things. The fact that he's not allowed to mix with the general prison population should mean that moves are made and certain things are granted to make his experience until he dies in prison at least marginally bearable. You won't be surprised, after listening to me describe the kind of living conditions that Maudsley is experiencing, that there have been suggestions that the glass prison used to house Dr. Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, you remember that? And Clarissa, that one. That the whole of that setup was partly inspired by Maudsley's incarceration. Now, whether that's true or not, one thing that we can distinguish is that it doesn't seem likely that Mortis is going to be engineering a dramatic escape plot like Lecter anytime soon. In fact, what's really sad, if I'm honest, is what's more likely for Robert Maudsley is that he's going to further have mental decline and likely spiral into depression further as his physical health fails. And until he finally dies, that's likely to be the case, which is just horrible. Another potential connection with the fictional Lecter is that Maudsley is said to have a genius level IQ, which breaks my heart because I always think to myself, you know, if you're born in the right postcode to the right parents with the right privileges, then with that genius IQ, how could his life have benefited the world? I also understand that an organized serial killer tends to have a higher IQ, some reaching genius level two. So it could just be that he fits that paradigm. But he is said to have a real love of classical music, of poetry, of art. He's apparently really keen to take an open university course in music theory, and that must be utter torture for an intelligent, inquisitive, curious mind to literally be trapped in a glass cage, unable to make those decisions for himself. And albeit that he's placed himself in that position initially, one could argue that the way that he is denied must add to his anguish. One thing that I have managed to find out is that in more recent years, Maudsley's apparently been given a few more comforts. And he says that he now feels like he's treated more like a man. He's allegedly allowed to watch television because, yeah, he was denied TV. He was denied the ability to listen to music, in spite of his love for it. So now he's allowed to listen to music too. Also has a PlayStation 2. And that in itself shows that there has been at least a recognition that you can't just leave this man in a glass cage to rot. It's absolutely inhuman. He did tell authorities that he does feel that if he was ever released, he would kill again. So he does now concur that he isn't safe to be on the streets. For me, what does that mean? Well, it's evidence without a shadow of a doubt of the complete failure to treat him or even to reform him in the slightest. He's been incarcerated for 40 plus years and now he believes that he wouldn't be allowed on the streets for fear that he would go ahead and kill people. He actually agrees with that position. Now, one of the things that he's managed to do, I would say, is to reframe his incarceration. And this has only happened recently. So all those years feeling like he was being treated completely unfairly, and I agree with that, he's now bought in to his incarceration in a different way. And I would imagine this is the only way that you can stay entirely sane if you are in such circumstances. He has turned his place, his cell, into his safe place. He's made it so that he has ownership of his territory, that he's choosing it as opposed to being placed in that scenario without any opportunity of escape. He's choosing it. It's a psychological way of making it bearable. So it does evidence to some degree of just how beyond reform he is now, because he agrees with what they're saying as far as the authorities, you're not safe to be on the streets. But now he's even internalized the fact that he doesn't want to go anywhere. His cell is where he wants to be. Ironic that potentially the thing that made the difference was having a PlayStation, having a TV, listening to music, being afforded those very basic human rights. Now it's so different to how it was when he was completely on his own, with no voices, with no freedoms, with no opportunities to just do what other people do. Even though he's only got this tiny fragment of what the rest of us experience in our freedom, it's been enough to make him content to some degree. I think, for me, what feels really unfair, though, is the damage that will have been done to him mentally after all the years. Because for me, what is very clear is he has been conditioned and institutionalized to such a degree, he actually believes he wants it now. My thoughts on this is that Maudsley is quite a unique and difficult case. His case raises some really important ethical issues. You know, is it okay to simply punish an offender without offering any prospect whatsoever of treatment or reform? I mean, Maudsley committed horrific crimes. but so have lots of other people, many, many, many other people, none of which have been subjected to the same prolonged psychological torture of solitary confinement, the endless monotony, the lack of human contact. That's all a surefire way to literally destroy someone's mental health and send them spiraling into madness. For someone like Maudsley, somebody who's got a history of abuse, mental illness, self-harm, violent episodes, it was always going to be a recipe for disaster. And indeed, as far as I am concerned, it has been. Lots of us believe that individuals who carry out reprehensible, heinous crimes should have to serve sentences that are not easy to bear. But if you can look at one prisoner who has done the same or worse than Maudsley and look at what they have been allowed in their time in prison, whether that's for life, as in term of natural life, or whether that's for a period of years, and then if you compare it with him and there's just massive, massive gap, polarities even of treatment, then we have to say that Maudsley has been treated unfairly by a system that should have been there to reform him. And certainly when you think about him being removed from his therapy that he was doing well in, that in itself is harrowing. And there's a little bit of me that feels that he could potentially have been punished more because he killed people in prison and the authorities don't like being humiliated that way. It happened on their watch. It called into question their professionality and he paid the price for that. None of that excuses the heinous crimes that he carried out. Like I said at the beginning of this, I think he's known by myths. Certainly, he did kill people who had abused children, but he also killed people who hadn't, so it doesn't fit in that way. He was never a cannibal and should not be known that way. And there is a bit of me that's like, give him a budgie. For God's sake, let him have a budgie. Genuinely, I just don't understand why they wouldn't allow him to do that. I personally wouldn't go for a budgie, no disrespect to budgie lovers out there. I have like a bad connection with it because I wanted a dog and my mum and dad didn't get me a dog when I was 7. They got me a budgie. He was green and called Peter and I gave him to my gran because you can't walk them. And if you let them out of the cage outside, they just fly off. That is not a dog. That's all I'm saying. So it gave my grandma many, many years of joy. My grandma then went on to have another 2 budgies, Bluey and Joey. So arguably, even though I didn't benefit from my budgie or birthday present, she did. I never did get another birthday present for that though. Nobody replaced it. I'm not bitter. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.